Today on the 21st, for years, PBS viewers have learned about what's happening in the world from the calm, measured presence of Judy Woodruff. The NewsHour anchor began her career as a secretary at a local TV station and has covered every presidential election since 1976.
I'm not here to give you opinion. If you want opinion, there are hundreds of other places you can turn. You know, turn on your, pick up your smartphone, go to your favorite cable channel. You're going to get opinion. It's all over. We're swimming in a sea of opinion right now.
I'm Brian Mackey, a conversation with Judy Woodruff for the hour. Today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. Airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Judy Woodruff is an institution in American broadcasting. The anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, her career spans more than five decades. She says she entered the news business through the back door, hired as a news secretary, earning $90 a week at WQXI-TV in Atlanta. This was 1968, and she found most stations did not want to put her on air. "We already have a woman reporter," they'd say, or, "We want to hire a reporter, not a woman." But she got a break covering the Georgia State House for a different Atlanta station, and then in the mid-1970s, in part due to FCC pressure to put more women on air, she was hired by NBC for its Atlanta bureau. When Georgia's own Jimmy Carter became president, NBC brought her to Washington as a White House correspondent. From there, she moved to PBS, then over to CNN, and finally back to PBS, where she co-anchored the NewsHour with Gwen Ifill and has led the show solo since Ifill's premature death in 2016. I had the opportunity to speak with Woodruff back in April for a special virtual event marking the 100th anniversary of our home station, WILL, which is part of Illinois Public Media. Our radio signal first went on the air 100 years ago next week, one of the first in the country. As our CEO, Moss Brosnahan, likes to point out, we were on the air several months before the creation of the BBC. I spoke with Woodruff about her early career and what makes the PBS NewsHour unique in television news. She also answered questions from listeners and journalism students. Because we taped this conversation, we're not taking calls, but I do love hearing what you thought about our show. Send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is my conversation with Judy Woodruff. The Washington Post once quoted you as saying, "I love asking questions and hate answering them." So that's a sentiment I share. So I want to begin by thanking you for making time to be with us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. Brian, I just have to say to Moss, what a treat it is to see you and to celebrate with you 100 years of WILL. I mean, what a historic occasion and just so exciting. What a great run you have had and you continue to have in the state of Illinois. And you hold the banner high for public media. And I'm just really, really glad to be with you and congratulations.
Well, thank you for that on behalf of all of us here at WILL and in our WILL community. I want to begin, though, on a little bit more of a somber note tonight. We're talking on March 30th, and I want to ask you to go back 41 years to the day you're covering the White House. You and an NBC News crew are in a small pool of reporters who are traveling with the president as he gives a speech that afternoon. And you're standing about 40 feet away from President Reagan on this day, 41 years ago, when John Hinckley opens fire on him, Press Secretary James Brady, two law enforcement officers. You reported from the scene. You were soon on the air from the White House. Can you talk about what lessons you took from that experience?
Well, thank you, Brian, for reminding us that of that sobering moment in American history when, you're right, John Hinckley, a young man, brought a gun to the Washington Hilton Hotel. And when President Reagan came out the door, he shot at the president and also hit several other people. I was there that day, Brian, because I was part of the pool. I was working for NBC News. The pool is a small representative group of reporters and camera people and photographers who travel with the president when he moves around, either moves around the city or travels by air or however, in a car, and to be there, to be the eyes and ears of the American people. And I remember it vividly because we were not allowed to ask him any questions inside. He was speaking to a labor group, and he'd only been in office 2 months. I mean, he'd been inaugurated on January the 20th, of course, just, and this was March the 30th, and just getting his feet on the ground as president of the United States, having been the governor of California for 8 years, comes out the door, and I'm shouting a question to him. I'm on the other side of the there was a string of cars who there were there, the usual, they had the several security cars, and then they had the press vans, and then they had the president's limousine, and then more Secret Service and so on. So, but it's all in a string of, I don't know, 10 or 12 cars. And I'm on the other side of where that iconic picture was, with a picture of, you know, the men who were down. I mean, the photographer, in fact, who took that picture just died in the last few days. But what happened was I was yelling a question about something going on in Poland. They were having protests. Their labor movement was having protests. I remember asking, I was just getting the words out of my mouth about Lech Walesa, who had been the leader of Poland's solidarity movement. And when we heard this pop, pop, pop sound, and of course, first you think, oh, somebody's shooting firecrackers, but then of course they wouldn't be doing that near the president. People are screaming, get down, which I did, along with a few other press people who were around me. I was only about 20 feet from the president's car on the other side, and very quickly had to make a decision. The press aide for the White House yelled at us, make a decision. Are you coming with us? Or are you going to stay here? And of course, I mean, I thought about going with the president. I'm supposed to be with the president, my job, but there I could see people lying on the ground. I recognized Jim Brady, president's press secretary, who had been gravely wounded, and two others, a policeman, and it turned out I didn't know it at the time, and a Secret Service agent. And I made the instant decision to stay there so that I could file. The cars, the motorcade pulled out 60 miles an hour. They were out of there. And then I had to scramble to find a phone. You remember, this is 1981. It's before the days of the cell phone. And all of us reporters began to scatter. Three or four ran into the Hilton Hotel. I looked in the door, no phone in the lobby was available. I ran across the street, got a phone in a federal office building just across the street, T Street, from the Hilton, and was on the phone with NBC to file for NBC Radio. But what was so, the hardest thing for me that day, Brian, was seeing Jim Brady, somebody I knew, somebody I had covered, had gotten to know him, his wife, and to see him lying on the ground with what was clearly a very serious head wound, not knowing whether he was alive or not. And it was very difficult. And also, frankly, not knowing if the president was all right. We assumed he was okay because he'd been pushed into a car, the motorcade had taken off. We had no way of knowing then that the motorcade would end up detouring on the way back to the White House. Everybody now knows the story. They were headed back to the White House when the president, the Secret Service agent, said, I think we just need to be careful. And I think at that point, the president felt blood on coming out of his shirt. So it was a moment that you never, ever prepare for. And you hope you'll never, ever see the likes of that again.
And you are scrambling. You describe going across the street, phoning in to NBC Radio. Then you call the Washington desk. You and your news crew have to commandeer a cab to get back to the White House, and then you spend the rest of the day on air.
Our White House correspondent, Judy Woodruff, can bring in further details. She's at the White House now in the press briefing room. Judy, can you help us?
Roger, yes. I was standing outside the Washington Hilton when the shooting started. We had just come out the door in a big hurry, as the press normally is after the president is leaving the place where he's made a speech and is ready to go back to the White House. We had started to walk toward his limousine to ask him some questions, but we noticed that the Secret Service, that some of the press office agents were rushing us along, and we didn't really get very close. And at about that point, I was probably one car length and a half away from the president's limousine when the shots were fired. people immediately.
People, you said even at the time, I read this in your 1983 book on your some of your early experiences reporting from Washington, that people were remarked on your composure and your ability to just deliver the news as you had it coming in. And there was a lot of confusion that day. People might not remember, but conflicting reports about the president, conflicting reports about
right.
James Brady and his condition and what had happened to him.
There were false reports made that Jim Brady had died, that there were different reports, a lot of confusion about the president's condition because the White House wasn't saying where he was. Initially, they didn't say where he was, and eventually he said he was in the hospital, but there was no report on how he was doing. We were led to believe it was mild, but nobody was really sure. We didn't know until we were hours into this that the president, you know, had been hit where he was hit, you know, in the side, and that, and frankly, none of us knew for a long time afterwards how close he came to dying. I mean, we learned much later that if the bullet had just been a fraction of an inch in a different direction, it could have, you know, killed him. I don't know. You asked me about composure. I don't know where that comes from. I think, again, I mean, at that point in my life, I'd been a reporter for all of 8 years. I started out in local news covering you mentioned you and Moss covered state capitol. I covered the Georgia state capitol. That was my first job and did that for 5 years. Before I joined NBC. And I think we all knew that our job is serious. We're there to report, we're there to get the facts. And that was what was driving me that day. But you're right, there was a lot of confusion and a lot of chaos, not only on our part, but on the part of the White House. You remember that was a day that that Al Haig, who you know, was at the White House and announced that he was in charge instead of the vice president. Vice President then George Bush. So, and then they had to clean that up. And there was just, it was chaos. It was chaos. Of course, it all sorted it out in a matter of days. But you also remember the president stayed in the hospital for weeks. And there were a lot of contradictory reports about how he was doing.
There's a way of looking at what happened that day in 1981 as the sort of coming at the end of a period of extraordinary public violence in America, going back to the Kennedy assassination, the other Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, the bombings throughout the 1970s, the Weather Underground, that sort of thing. Sometimes it feels like we're entering another era of public violence in America. Do you see a through line connecting that time and where we are today?
Well, I certainly hope that we're not entering another era where we have an assassination of a president as we did in 1963 and where we have attempted assassinations. I mean, Gerald Ford had two experiences. For President Reagan, it was one. And we know that every president receives threats. It's just, it comes with the job. I certainly hope that we're not entering an era where our presidents are targeted openly. And you know, we want to believe that the security is greater, and we want to believe that people can work out their differences in a different way. But I think what you're touching on, Brian, is just how politically divided we are today, how viscerally polarized we are as a country. I mean, I sometimes say for years and years, I've covered American politics, and people have disagreed with each other. They felt free to express their differences. But today, it's not just, you're not just talking about people who disagree with you. They're people who consider you the enemy. They consider you not patriotic, not a good American. I mean, we have crossed over a kind of a bridge in that regard, so that you're no longer my adversary, you're my enemy. It's a difficult time in our country. As I said, I mean, I hope we're not heading into a period where our presidents are going to be targeted as they were in the 60s and the 70s and then into the 80s, but it's pretty brutal out there. And there's certainly, you know, when you think about what happened at the Capitol on January the 6th of last year, the fact that many of the people who went into the Capitol were armed, thank God no one used, that there wasn't more mayhem than there was. We know that one woman was shot by the police as she was breaking in a door to get into the Capitol, and she died. And there were other deaths of police, and we know some of the protesters, the rioters, a couple of them died. But it could have been much, much worse than it was. And to this day, as you know, the country remains divided over exactly what happened. There are people who continue to insist that these people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th were simply exercising their First Amendment rights, and they had every right to be in a public building. Well, that's not exactly the case. We have the right to be there as long as it doesn't infringe on the work that's being done there by the United States Congress and by the members of Congress, and particularly on that day when they were counting and certifying, not counting, but certifying the presidential election outcome. And so it was a sobering time. We are still in a sobering time. And it colors so much of what we cover in the city today. It's hard to think of an issue that the two sides have come together on. I'm thinking of the war in Ukraine. In a way, it has brought the two political parties together. There's generally agreement, broad agreement, widespread agreement, that the United States should be helping the Ukrainian people as much as we can to fend off this terrible and brutal war that the Russians have started and are carrying out right now. There is disagreement over tactics and how much and when and so forth, but in general, it's brought us together. We do tend to come together when there's a crisis, but we are clearly in a politically polarized time, and like so many Americans, I hope we can find our way through it, and come out better on the other side.
Okay, we need to take a break. More from my conversation with Judy Woodruff when we return. This is the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with PBS NewsHour anchor and managing editor Judy Woodruff. This was recorded back in April during a virtual event, part of the year-long celebrations of the 100th anniversary of our home public radio station here at the 21st, WILL, Illinois Public Media. Let's turn to talking a little more about the PBS NewsHour. You anchor a program. It was once called the McNeil Lehrer Report, and then the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. I have to imagine you could have bargained to have it called the NewsHour with Judy Woodruff if you wanted to do that. But can you talk about the ethos of public broadcasting that cuts against that branding that's so common now in news and television news in particular?
Well, you know, I've never thought about that, because by the time Gwen Ifill and I were named the co-anchors, this is after Jim Lehrer had stopped. He basically stopped anchoring after 2011, and he named five of us as sort of rotating anchors. And then about a year and a half, 2 years after that, he and Robin McNeil, who still at that point ran and owned McNeil Lehrer Productions, announced that they wanted Gwen and me to be the sole anchors. Co-anchors of the program. You know, and Gwen and I used to talk about this. We are stewards of this program, and when we stop being part of this, we want to hand it off to the next team in very good shape. And that was always our goal.
It puts me in line. I don't know if you're familiar with that old journalism movie Deadline USA. Humphrey Bogart plays this crusading newspaper editor, and he has this line in there: a journalist makes himself the hero of the story, a reporter is only the witness. And I think that really embodies what I see the NewsHour trying to do. Can you talk about how you view your role in the idea of journalism or a reporter?
Our entire mission, I mean, the ethos of the NewsHour when I came there from NBC in 1983 was to be witness to the most important stories of the day to say, okay, we have an hour each night, five nights a week, Monday through Friday, to tell you what are the most important things that happened in the world that day, in our country, in the world, things that you need to know to make you a good citizen, things that you need to know that help you understand whether we're safe, you know, what are the national security challenges facing our country and the world, what are the issues we need to understand as Americans, what's our government doing, how are we holding our public officials accountable. And something that we're increasingly doing over the last many years, frankly, is the arts in this country. I mean, how are we doing? I mean, what are some of our writers saying to us about who we are as Americans right now and what our values are and what kind of art is being created, what kind of music? And so all of that goes into the mix. And we try to think of a balanced diet of the kinds of news that we think people need to know and want to know, need to know in order to function as citizens of this great country. But we're witnesses. We're not there to tell you what to think or how to vote. We're there to give you the information, and then you listen to that, you pay attention, and you decide. And we hope we are answering your questions every night. If we're not, we'll keep trying the next night.
What you're talking about, it reminds me or raises in my mind this idea of discussions in media circles over whether news reporters can or should strive for objectivity in their news coverage. And the press thinker Jay Rosen, for example, is critical of what he calls a view from nowhere style reporting. He says that drives down trust in the press, and it would be better to say, here's where I'm coming from. So I guess my question to you is, where are you coming from every night when that red light goes on?
Well, it's neither one of those polar ends that you just described. I don't think there's any such thing as objectivity in reporting. We're humans. I'm the sum total of all of my experiences. I'm a woman. I'm a grandmother. I'm a journalist for the last 40, 50 years of my life. I've worked in Atlanta. I've worked in Washington. I've mainly covered politics. I have a family, as I mentioned. All of that informs who I am, but it's not going to color my view of a particular story. It will certainly affect the stories that I think are important for us to tell. And a good example of that is, you know, today, I just think we're doing a much better job of covering all of America. There was a time when we really only covered white men in America. You know, and then we eventually were covering white men and women. And today I think we're not perfect yet by any means, but we're doing a better job of covering the lives of everybody, or trying to, whether you are Black or Hispanic, white, whether you are young or old, whether you have disabilities. We have a commitment to cover, you know, the entirety of America. And I hope we're doing a better job of that. We're never perfect, but hopefully we're doing better than we were. But what I want to say is that, I don't think there's any such thing as objectivity. On the other hand, I'm not here to give you opinion. If you want opinion, there are hundreds of other places you can turn, you know, pick up your smartphone, go to your favorite cable channel or your favorite, blog or website, and you're going to get opinion. It's all over. We're swimming in a sea of opinion right now. But I feel so strongly that, the reason I got into journalism in the first place was to tell people what's going on in the world, and to try to be as factual as I possibly can be, to gather information, to make sure the public knows as we're reporting a story that we don't have the whole story yet. We've only, you know, this is just breaking right now. We're telling you what's going on. This is what we know. But also to offer analysis on the news hour, the kind of informed analysis that explains the story. Why is this happening? How is it happening? But again, when it gets to controversial things, when it's, you know, how high should my taxes be? Should we have a tax on billionaires? What should government be telling us to do about wearing a mask or getting vaccinated? It's your decision to make. We can try to give you as much information as possible to help you make the right decision.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. This is from a virtual event back in April when I spoke with Judy Woodruff, anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, celebrating the 100th anniversary. This was from a virtual event celebrating the 100th anniversary of our home station here at the 21st WILL. You've had such an interesting and eventful career, and since we don't have unlimited time, I thought maybe we could do a little bit of a lightning round where I'll say a name, you tell me what that person either taught you or meant to you, or maybe share an experience with them. And I mean, I said lightning round, take as much time as you'd like answering, but the first name I want to ask you about is Pauline Frederick.
Oh my goodness. She was one of the first, she was a pioneer. I mean, I think you or Mosh used the word pioneer referring to me, and I do feel like a pioneer, but she truly was a pioneer. She worked for NBC News, maybe another network before that. She covered the United Nations. And I would hear her on the radio, and then I would see her on TV. I remember mainly hearing her on the radio. And she had this very authoritative, deep voice. And I, listening to her, I thought, okay, women can do this. And I have to say, the reason I needed that reassurance is because when I started out in the news world, I was the secretary for the news department of a TV station in Atlanta. It was the only job I could get right out of Duke University. And I was hired to clean the film, answer the phone, write letters for the news director. That was the job. And I was happy to have it. I was not complaining. But when I applied for a job as a reporter, I was basically told we already have a woman reporter by that station. I was told by multiple radio stations, and this was 1969. I was told by many, many radio stations around the country, if they even bother to write me back, we don't think women's voices are authoritative. So this is just a few years later that I'm hearing Pauline Frederick covering this important institution, the United Nations. And it gives me hope that maybe there's a place for me out there somewhere. So she was really, really important. I'm sure not just for me, but for so many other women who went into journalism.
What about Bob Brennan?
Oh my gosh, you really did do your research, Brian. He was the news director of the CBS affiliate in Atlanta who hired me to be a reporter. I was a secretary at the ABC affiliate, the newsroom secretary. And I'll tell you a secret. In the last 6 months, if you've looked at my book, you already know this. In the last 6 months I was a secretary, the news director there, he knew I was interested in becoming in a reporting. And he kept saying to me, we already have a woman reporter. I don't know why you're interested. But he said to me one day, he came up to me one day and he said, well, we've just fired our weekend weather girl. That's what he said. And he said her name. And he said, are you interested in auditioning for that? And I said, no, thank you. I'm not. And because he knew I wanted to be a reporter. Well, he said, well, look, if you're ever going to get any on-air experience, I highly, strongly recommend that you do this. I know you may not be what you want to do, but against my will, and because he was urging me to do this, I went ahead and tried out. I thought I was awful, but they hired me to be the Sunday night 11 p.m. weather girl. So it was like Cinderella. During the week, I was there cleaning the film, answering the phone Monday through Friday. And then I would come in on Sunday nights at 6 o'clock and go through the weather wires. This is back in the day when the UPI and AP tickers came off these big, loud machines. They were just feeding paper constantly. And you'd rip it off. And we had the weather wire that was part of that. And I would pull those weather stories and memorize everything that I could. And then I would make notes on this big plexiglass map that was in the back of the newsroom. And then they would come to me at 11, this was the 11 o'clock news, so probably 11:15 or 11:20 into the show, they would come to me for 4 or 5 minutes to talk about, you know, a low over, you know, Dubuque, and or the, you know, the high today was in Houston, Texas, or wherever it was. And I had made little tiny notes to myself so I could see what I was saying. I thought I was awful at that. But I did it because, again, I was told you should do this. And I, long story short, when I digressed, but after 6 months, we sort of mutually agreed that this was not my cup of tea. Bob Brennan, who was the news director at the CBS station, called me up and he said, we've lost our reporter covering the state legislature. Would you be interested? I mean, I'd already had conversations with him. And he said, I've seen you doing the weather. And so I said, you have? I thought that would kill my chance. But he, I went over and he, you know, interview and audition and all that stuff that they want you to do. And then he hired me. And in fact, funny you should ask me, Brian, I spoke with Bob Brennan about a week and a half ago. He's now 93 years old. He lives in Atlanta, is still an amazing man. And I was asking him, you know, why did you hire me? We've had this conversation before. And he said, well, I just thought, you know, you had a political science degree from Duke and you'd taken a year of Russian. And I thought, you know, I thought maybe you could cover the Georgia legislature. So put two and two together.
Yeah. And of course, that leads to the Atlanta NBC bureau position. And then eventually they brought you to the White House to cover Jimmy Carter. I do want to get to some listener questions, but I want to ask you about one more name. And you alluded to her earlier. I hope this is not too painful a topic, but Gwen Ifill.
Oh, my goodness. Gwen, such an icon in American journalism, a symbol, I think, for all women, and particularly for women of color. Gwen, her father was a minister, and she grew up, they moved a lot when she was growing up. He was, but mainly she grew up in the Northeast, and she tells a story about after she graduated from college and knew she wanted to be a reporter, she had been hired, I think, right out of college at Boston Herald. And she, the reason I'm sharing this story is because I think it just begins to tell you just how much courage Gwen had. She'd only been there, I think, a day or two, and somebody left a note on her desk at the Boston Herald. And this would have been in the 1980s, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the late 70s, saying, you know, with a racist, an ugly racist note. And she just ignored it. And I think, I'm not even sure she made many comments about it. I think she told her boss, but said, I'm not bothered by this. And she continued to work there. And then, of course, the rest is history. She, you know, was a star everywhere she went. She ended up working at the New York Times and then NBC News. And then, of course, she came to PBS to the NewsHour. And I think 1997, it was during the period I had been at the NewsHour from 83 till 93. And then I went to work for CNN for a while. Jim Lehrer used to say I was wandering in the wilderness of cable television.
He would ask you how the Home Shopping Network was.
That's right. How did you know that? He called it the Home Shopping Network. We used to have a good laugh. But Gwen was just not only brilliant and the kind of person who people gravitate to, funny, fearless in many ways. I mean, she called them as she saw them. She couldn't stand to see people treated unfairly or to be overlooked. And she was just one of some. By the time I came back to the NewsHour in 2007, I'd been at CNN, left CNN, not sure what I was going to do or where I was going to go, but did a documentary project. And in that process, got pulled back into the orbit of the NewsHour, rejoined in 2007. And Gwen and I were colleagues. I mean, I knew her as a friend, but we hadn't been close friends. We became very good friends. And then, as I said, after Jim Lehrer retired, he eventually named us in 2013. And we decided early on that we were going to be, you know, inseparable in terms of co-anchors, that, you know, there'd be a lot of talk and gossip about they must be feuding. It's the, you know, the story about women can't get along with each other. And that was never the case with us. I had her back. She had my back. I was always, you know, I was cheering for her and everything that she did. And losing her in 2016, at the end of the year, right after the election, was devastating for all of us. But she, you know, her legacy, her message lives on at the NewsHour and everything we do.
We're listening back to a virtual event from back in April, in which I spoke with PBS NewsHour anchor Judy Woodruff. We need to take a break. We'll continue the conversation, and Judy will answer listener questions. When we return, you're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to a conversation I recorded back in April with Judy Woodruff, managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, also the anchor of the NewsHour. This was recorded as part of a virtual event celebrating the 100th anniversary of our home public radio station here at The 21st, WILL. Before the break, Woodruff was talking about her long friendship and partnership with Gwen Ifill. They were co-anchors of the NewsHour together until Ifill died suddenly in 2016. And Woodruff has led the show solo since that time. Between the Trump administration and the COVID-19 pandemic, the pace of news has been relentless for going on 6 years now. And that brings us to our first listener question, which is from Ruth in Champaign, who asks, how do you keep yourself recharged in the face of delivering often grim news day after day?
Ruth, that's such a good question. And I have to ask myself that, frankly, every once in a while, because the news has been relentlessly hard. We had a hard-fought election in 2016. The country was very divided. And of course, during the next 4 years, during the Trump presidency, the country was very politically divided. We had a president who was regularly belittling and worse in his attitude toward the press, calling us enemies of the American people. In my view, nothing could be further from the truth, but that was how he saw it. And I guess he said the other day, he's repeated it, continues to believe that. That then along came COVID at the beginning of 2020. And just turmoil in so much of our lives. All I can tell you is that I believe, number one, I am backed up by the most phenomenal news organization, the PBS NewsHour team. You don't see most of them on the air every day, but from the top to the bottom, from our executive producer, Sarah Just, to our team of correspondents, and they've grown over the years. You see them now on the air every night. There are, 9, 10 of them. And then there are those who, like Paul Solman, who covers economics, or Jeffrey Brown, who covers the arts and for us. I mean, we have just an extraordinary team, from Amna Nawaz to Lisa Desjardins, William Brangham, and I'm leaving somebody out, John Yang, and on down the list. They're all just fabulous. So them, and then a whole layer of producers and associate producers and other folks who just make the place the amazing machine that it is. And I mean a machine with a heart, because we are still like a family. We've grown bigger. I think we now have over 150 employees, but compared to the major commercial television news networks, we're much, much smaller, and we still think of ourselves as a family. So that's the first thing, is I'm backed up by this amazing team, and I know they have my back. I certainly try to have theirs. And the other thing is that I'm determined that we're going to get the job done every day, that no matter what the news is, no matter how terrible it is, that like the day I had to tell our audience that Gwen had died, there was another day in 2020 when I had to tell the people that Jim Lehrer had died that day. Whether it's the worst of the COVID stories or the Ukraine stories we've been covering for the last month. So much of this is absolutely heartbreaking, but I'm committed to my job. I think it's really important that people know they can count on the NewsHour for the information that they need. And it's the reason I get up every morning.
Well, since you brought up the team at the NewsHour, we had another question from Nick in Crawfordsville, Indiana, who wondered how many millennial or Generation Z staffers work on the NewsHour, and if you could talk about how their perspectives influence their older coworkers.
You know, I wish I had a count, but I think they are clearly more than half of us. they're all considerably younger than I am. You can imagine, if I've been doing this for 50 years, you can do the math. Many of them are in their 20s.
We stay the same age. The producers keep getting younger, right?
Many of them are in their 20s. They're just a few years out of college or just out of college. But many of them also have worked in other news organizations, and they bring their talent to the NewsHour, and they, you know, they're working with us in editing, in working with us in social media. We have now, I think just the other day, we surpassed 3 million YouTube, I think this is right, viewers. I may not have it exactly right, but we've put enormous emphasis on, under the leadership of our executive producer, Sarah Just, on expanding our social media and online presence. So the online news hour is every bit as important to us as the television news hour. And we are available all the time, YouTube, online. And then in addition to that, we have a robust Facebook presence, Twitter, Instagram, and we're just starting, I can tell you a secret, TikTok in the next few days. So, you know, there was a time, I think, when the news hour thought, gee, you know, we don't need to go there. That was probably a decade ago. But it's pretty clear today that you cannot reach the younger generation and where they are, which is what we, our mission is, to go where you are, to bring you the news. And if you're getting your news through one of these other formats, platforms, we want to be there for it. And so that's, many of the young people we've hired are just brilliant in coming up with creative ways to tell important stories. And I distinguish between what we're doing and what I see some other organizations doing, which are, it's all about celebrities or, you know, your favorite cat. And I love cats and dogs too. And don't get me wrong, I love all those animal stories. But there's a meaning, there's a story, there's a real story there behind the kind of reporting that you see with the news air. You're going to learn something every time you see a piece we do on TikTok or Instagram or one of these other platforms. And of course, the central mission of the news hour is to tell you the most important things that happened that day. We're going to find ways to tell you those things on several different platforms and in different ways. But one way or another, we're going to get it across, and we're going to find you where you are. And that's what drives us. And the young people are the ones who are driving that. I mean, they are so smart. They all care about journalism. And there was a time not so long ago, Brian, when I worried that the press was under so much more than scrutiny, just distrust. And that still is an issue in this country. There's a serious lingering distrust of the news media. And we have to work hard every day to earn that, to earn the trust that we have, and to earn back the trust of those individuals, Americans who've just given up on the media. We have to work hard to earn that, earn their trust, earn their confidence. And in order to do that, we can't flag. I mean, we can't give up, get discouraged. And these young people get that. I mean, they care about journalism, the kind of journalism that Jim and Robin started back in 1975. It may be coming out, it may be formatted differently, but the purpose is still there.
Well, I'm now really excited to see what the NewsHour does on TikTok.
Me too. I can't wait.
We have a question from a student journalist. Allison is a senior at the University of Illinois and asks, over your career, have your methods for building respect with your sources and audience changed over time? You've talked a lot about the audience. What about sources? Has that changed in Washington in your career?
That's a very good question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that question, Allison. So kudos to you for coming up with an original question. I think what I would say is that over time and with experience, I want to believe that I have better judgment about who to believe. There were a lot of mistakes I made early in my career. People would tell me things and I would assume because I thought that person was in a position to know that I could report that. And of course, I found out with experience. You have to remember, I never studied journalism. No, I never took a course. I had to learn on the fly. I learned from colleagues, and I learned very much by trial and error. But I think over time, I've learned to take everything with a grain of salt, to know that always to think about where is this information coming from? Where, if it's not a document that is pretty neutral and it's coming from a person, what is that person's attitude here? I mean, what do they want the outcome to be? Do they have skin in this game? Do they want, you know, do they, if they have a strong interest in the story being told a certain way, then I'm going to take what they say with some, let's say, a grain of salt. And remember that that may be only half the story. I may come to find out that they're giving me the exact straight scoop after I've checked it out with other people. But I think with experience, I think these 50 some years of doing this has given me, it's given me the ability to not rush to judgment and to weigh what I hear and what I read and what I'm told based on, you know, who's saying it and what the circumstances are. I think some reporters get that more quickly than others. I'd like to think I'm better at it today, but it's not to say I haven't made mistakes. People have told me things that turned out not to be the case. And you learn from that. The people who burn you, as we, the expression we use in journalism, you learn not to trust them again.
I know we're coming to the end of our hour. I want to get a few more questions from some of our listeners in. Jeff from Springfield asks, of all the presidents you've covered, which one did you find had the best sense of humor?
Very good. Let me think about that. I mean, they all had kind of a sense of humor. Maybe Barack Obama. I mean, he would, not because I covered it, I wasn't covering the White House then, but whenever I was in a situation where I was able to ask him questions, he likes to sort of tweak the press, if you will. I mean, he's very fond of kind of lightly making fun of the situation that you're in. I think President George W. Bush had a good sense of humor. I mean, he also liked to sort of tweak reporters sometimes. So I'd say maybe both of them. I'll give them the best rating for sense of humor.
I'll share a comment from another listener. Alexander says, my mother wrote to Judy's assistant and requested an autographed headshot for me for my birthday last year, and she did it. Wanted to know how you had time in your schedule to do that. Thank you, Judy. It was one of the most thoughtful presents I ever received.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad. Happy birthday.
Another student question, Sydney from Urbana, journalism student at U of I. Big fan of the PBS NewsHour since I was very young. I wonder if Judy might have any advice for students like me that look forward to working as a journalist.
My advice is to, I don't know at what stage you are in your education, but is to read as much as you can, absorb as much history as you, if you want to be a reporter, absorb as much history as you can, soak it all up, understand as much about American history, world history, because that's the context that you'll need to have as you go out there and you cover, whether it's legal issues or political issues or economic issues or whatever it is. Yes, it's different. I mean, if you decide that you're going to cover the arts, but I still think if you're covering the arts, you're going to be talking to writers and artists who are thinking about the context of this country and where the American people are and where the where hearts and minds are at this moment. And so you need to understand where we are as an American people, where we fit in the river of life and the river of, you know, as history unfolds. So that's my advice to young people. If you want to go into reporting, first of all, you have to be curious. If you've got the curiosity, bless you, you're going to need that and it'll take you a long way. But learn as much as you can about this country, because that is going to provide the backdrop for every bit of work. So much of the work that you do as a reporter.
Well, Judy Woodruff, anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, thank you so much for doing what you do and the team for doing what they do and for spending your evening with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
It is my honor, Brian. I thoroughly enjoyed your questions and the questions from folks who are watching. And I just want to say Happy 100th again to WILL. Congratulations on the amazing work that you all do, holding the banner high for public media in Illinois. It is just so important. Public media to me, it's close to my heart. It's a calling, and I just want to celebrate with all of you. It's an honor to be with you.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.